And they interviewed women on how they know. And I was much bothered by the first group called the Silent Knowers. These were women who were victims of incest or other abuse as children and never developed a self and never developed a voice. And I realized that a lot of them were sitting in seminary. And I had never, in my PhD work, studied anything about that. And I got to reflecting on how we know and realized that the whole premise of my education had been that we all know in the same way. And I knew experientially that that was bull, even though it took me a long time to come to that awareness. Where I now teach, the Women's Theological Center, we begin each year of the study action program with a task called Faith Journeys. And we set for ourselves cooperatively and corporately the task of mapping out our faith journeys, primarily visually. It's a marvelous way of trying to break the tyranny of words only in education, in theology. I was very struck this year, just last week, when all of the women began their faith journey with photographs. The oldest photograph was the photograph of a slave woman on the block. But the photos that were used were all of family and friends, from slaves to immigrant grandparents and great-grandparents to current family and friends. And I thought how intriguing it was that we all began with a medium that is only 150 years old. And I realized that when I was in graduate school, to my recollection, a photograph never showed up in class. We learned as if photography had never been invented. As a matter of fact, I think we learned as if oil painting had never been invented. It was primarily a verbal medium. I'd like to ask you to indulge me this evening because this is going to be largely an old-style lecture, which I am not enthusiastic too much about doing. But I'm going to hope that you will be able to use your own questioning and answering as I'm talking. If it gets too absurd or too boring, simply interrupt. I awakened at 3 o'clock this morning. And it could be that I will simply follow the text and be asleep and not know it. I know from facial expressions that many of you have experienced that sitting in seminary listening. I'm using visual arts as an entry into questions of epistemology because I think it breaks our expectations a bit and gets us thinking with different synapses in the brain. I want to be clear about something. I used to be a person who never, ever used the same lecture twice. I thought that it was necessary to think up something from scratch every single time, and that fed nicely into my workaholic tendencies. I want to be clear, I've used this lecture twice. And I'm still immensely curious about it and curious about reactions. So I'm not pretending that this is created new. Tomorrow and the next lecture are utterly new. But this one, I need your response because, as you will see by the end of it, knowing is a corporate activity, not an individual activity, and I need you to know what I know. I worked for 9 years at Boston University and hardly ever got to the museums in Boston. Although I've been a visually curious person. But after I was fired, I started going to the museum. This proves that God exists. And one of my favorite exhibits in the past 2 years was the exhibit of the Spanish painter Goya. And this exhibit drew me many times to the museum because once I had no money, I took out a membership and I could go free all the time then after the initial $35. It was Goya's social realism primarily that drew me to his work, but it was also his use of the ambiguity of light and darkness to subvert my expectations. I liked immensely his critique of self-satisfied power. I was recently fired by John Silber, so I liked that especially. And I liked it that he critiqued self-satisfied power, whether it was in the church or in the government. I liked Goya's willingness to confront evil without mystifying it. He didn't try to doctor it up, name it something else. He simply portrayed it boldly face on. And I liked immensely his struggle with the revolutionary age. But it was the art historian Fred Licht who interpreted Goya in a way which clarified for me why Goya seemed to be such a contemporary, as if I were watching the evening news rather than simply looking at the walls of a museum of somebody who worked in the 18th century primarily and the early 19th. Licht argues in a study of Goya that we have here in this man the beginning of the modern temper in art. I urge you to think now, when would you place the beginning of the modern and of what uses it to you in your ministries, in your congregations, and elsewhere? The first instance of this initiation of me struck me so deeply that I turned to it literally daily. And that initiation was a painting of Goya's in the cupola of a church in Madrid. And I was reminded when I walked in here today, looking at this ceiling, of this dimension of the lecture. Before Goya, painters painted as if gravity did not exist, especially when they painted in churches. Goya did not paint angels and animals and human beings floating in heaven in divine weightlessness. God held them up, and you didn't have to worry about gravity in the ceiling of the church. But Goya changed that. He knew about gravity. He knew about Newtonian gravity, and he knew about political gravity. Goya painted, when he painted the cupola of the church, you know that domey part up there? And he painted all these figures, including St. Anthony. St. Francis is my favorite, so I always put him in. It doesn't belong. Including St. Anthony, and so you have the angels and other figures, a lot of very working class people circling around the cupola, and then he painted an iron fence in front of them so that they can't fall down. And nobody had ever done that before. Think of how that changes how you think about the world and God, to say you can no longer count on this being exceptional divine space. The space in the church is like the space in the Empire State Building. And even though you trust God, you hold on to the fence when you climb up to the top of the Empire State. Licht writes that in the old days, and I'm quoting now, space fell under the control of divine will and had a distinctly ethical meaning because it was the stage on which God's commandments became manifest. That's the old days. Goya changed all that. For him, space was earthly space with its concomitant gravity and its concomitant lack of religious meaning. It's the end of the quotation. But Goya moved further than simply secularizing space. Responding to the unmitigated horror of the wars of his age, he portrayed a world without a center. And this was long before Yeats thought of his rough beast. In a series of drawings called Disasters, Goya rejects the comforts of perspective and organized pictorial space with their focus, which assures the human mind of its ability to comprehend the world. Think of most of the pictures in Egermeyer's Bible storybook. That kind of traditional art had everything nicely organized. You knew where you stood in relation to the picture drew you in, made you feel comfortable, and everything made spatial sense. Licht describes Goya's redefining of space. He says, the framed picture of earlier painting contains within its limits all the clues that we need for a rational interpretation of the image. And all the objects within the frame are related to each other and not to something that's outside of our vision. Everything you needed to know, you knew by looking at the painting. Think of Rembrandt even still. But, Licht says, Goya's kind of infinity, which has no center, no beginning, and no end, necessarily implies that whatever we single out can be nothing but a fragment. we are made emphatically aware of the fragmentary nature of our perception. This is shifting from the Renaissance Baroque epoch, and where they convinced us by presenting us with something that life constantly withholds, that is, something entirely consistent with itself, something so self-contained that it lives beyond the exigencies of time and destruction. That was the old world. Goya insists on making us aware of the fractional, incomplete, and ephemeral nature of all human experience. And that's why Licht says he begins the modern era. I turned then to try to understand this. By the way, one of Goya's teachers was a judge in the Inquisition. And his job was to find out which paintings of nudes were heretical and immoral. And Goya made the list a lot because he shifted from that pseudo-realism of the literal-minded that so plagues the church. And he moved into a critique, a subverting of the dominant expectations, and his old teacher found him guilty, of course. I turned then to a British historian and art critic, John Berger, to look at some of the same shifts in art, but Berger takes it further into the 19th century. He begins again in my excerpting right here, looking at the convention of perspective. I'm going to stop a second. How many of you have thought in the past 5 years about perspective as a mental convention? It's not, some, okay? But this might seem a little obtuse. So stop and think how, when you look from the boat today toward the mountains, you do not see as a Renaissance painter would have painted that view, because you do not have the converging lines of perspective focusing on your two eyeballs, naturally. If that sounds a little screwy, hold your judgment, willingly suspend your disbelief for 2 minutes. Describing the convention of perspective unique to European art, Berger writes, "This convention centers everything on the eye of the beholder. It is like a beam from a lighthouse, only instead of light traveling outwards, appearances travel in." Right now they're doing it if your eyes are open, which is true for half, anyhow. The conventions call these appearances reality. Perspective makes the single eye the center of the visible world. Everything converges onto the eye as to the vanishing point of infinity. The visible world is arranged for the spectator as the universe was once thought to be arranged for God. End of quotation. But this understanding of perspective, that the universe is arranged for this infinite vision of the perceiver, this understanding of perspective contained an inherent contradiction. It structured all images of reality to address a single spectator, you the viewer in front of the painting, who, unlike God, could only be in one place at a time. This contradiction became apparent for the general population, not so much by means of Goya's drawings, because the general population never saw them at the time, but it became apparent for the general population when photography was invented. Berger writes, "Every drawing or painting that used perspective proposed to the spectator that he was the unique center of the world. The camera, and more particularly the movie camera, demonstrated that there was no center. The fractional, incomplete, and ephemeral nature of all human experience finds its appropriate means. If you really want to portray how we see reality, following this shift in perspective and the understanding of vision and knowing, take a look at movies. The camera, which records the non-converging lines of the world, not the artifice of infinity converging on the self." And Berger then draws the development of this decentering of the infinite viewer's perspective into painting. He says, "For the impressionist, the visible no longer presented itself to humans in order to be seen. On the contrary, the visible in continual flux became fugitive. We could now spend a lot of time comparing this with the search for Jesus in biblical criticism in the 19th century. That would be just flashed through my mind, actually, as a connection. I don't want to take it in that direction. But we have just moved from the notion that you have all of reality objectively available to you as infinite viewer to the notion that reality is only available as flux and never as itself directly. And hence, we have an undermining of the confidence of knowing within this period of art. This became marvelously apparent in the huge Monet exhibit in Boston, the exhibit of the haystacks, basically, grain stacks. When I went to this exhibit, I was not prepared to love it, and indeed it transformed my life, as it turned out, because the interpreter of the exhibit started interpreting Monet politically, just as many people are now interpreting the Bible politically, rather than in some pseudo subjective individualistic sense. Monet's France 100 years ago was a France, sounds familiar, losing its preeminence in the world. It was a France worried about its national identity, struggling to define itself for a future along the fault lines of industrialization on an agrarian foundation, and often falling into nationalism and racism in the process. One of the reasons I love the Monet exhibit is because Monet painted for a culture that is very much like the United States in the last part of the 20th century. Common artistic wisdom has said that Monet painted all these haystacks as studies in light without any political significance or social material reference. Or, in other words, Monet was impressionism as subjectivist escapism. But Paul Hayes Tucker, has challenged this in the exhibit that was assembled for the centennial of the Monet exhibit of haystacks. Tucker showed that Monet chose the subject matter of these paintings in direct response to the struggle of French national identity. What have been casually called paintings of haystacks are in fact grain stacks, that is, not yet threshed harvest. And the grain stacks were chosen by Monet to reaffirm the agrarian base of the nation and the values associated with it. Parenthetical observation, if you want to make money in photography these days in the United States, take photographs of farms. That sells in part because there's an attempt to reestablish the old days of identity of farm life in the United States. Tucker writes, however, that Monet rarely painted grain stacks standing alone, but rather he painted them in the context of the houses and economy of those local villages in France. In every case, Tucker writes, Monet is careful to establish the relationships between the haystacks or the grain stacks and the people who inhabited the houses. But it's not simply that there is an economic interpretation of what was purely subjectivist impressionism. But it's the series nature of the painting which intrigued me immensely. I have a study, since I live in a place on a street, a study that looks out at one of the few trees on that street in Boston. And I had taken a series of photographs of that tree over four seasons. And so I was quite surprised when I walked into the Monet exhibit and saw this sequence of paintings of the haystacks. And that is what gives it its peculiarly modern temper. Monet painted at least 25 paintings of these same grain stacks in the field near his home. Imagine something that's near your house that you think you know thoroughly. And then imagine a painter coming along painting 25 versions of that item. The Monet series is a series because, in Tucker's sense of series, there's always a consistent point of view on the same object. You come back next year to Holden and you paint the cross again. You come back in February, paint it again. You're always taking a consistent point of view. That's one characteristic of this series. That is, the photographer or the painter always stands in the same place. The second characteristic is that there's a relationship among all these views. the nuances have a cohesion to them. They aren't simply random sequential moments in the paintings. So that once the subject matter is chosen, many paintings of the same thing need to be made to convey what's really going on. And the paintings always share the same format and the same formal characteristics. So they are, in fact, a series, but very different paintings of one particular subject matter. What does this mean? It says that once you have fragmented nature and space so that no particular place can be understood to function as a microcosm of the divine, the knowing of the particular could move to infinity in any case. I'm going to repeat that sentence. Once nature and space have been fragmented so that no particular place can be understood to function as a microcosm of the divine, the knowing of the particular could move to infinity. You can never be confident that you have comprehensive knowing of anything. Short of moving to infinity, which is the case for all of us, not being divine, short of moving to infinity, the creating of the meaning of the grain stacks, in Monet's case, is effected not through one, but 25 answers. I don't know of a single seminary in the United States which operates on this premise. They all operate on a Renaissance Baroque model of knowing. The grain stack's reality is not present in any one of the paintings. You can't take one of them on a wall in the Boston Museum and say that you know what the meaning of the grain stack series is. Their reality is not present in any one of the paintings, but only in the series as a whole. The meaning of the grain stack is not only its look and context in the morning, but also in the evening, not only in winter, but also in late autumn. Monet then carried this epistemological insight into his paintings of poplars and the Rouen Cathedral. And after several years of paintings, he finally holds together French identity over the serious fault line of culture running through nature by merging the cathedral and his beloved French poplars into one organic edifice. You can see paintings of the Rouen Cathedral which look like the poplars and vice versa. You can no longer so sharply distinguish the sacred and the natural in Monet's work. But the secularizing of space seems inevitable in the decentering multiplicity of the modern eye. Tucker writes, "Grounded in the tangible realities of nature and paint, Monet's cathedrals professed a faith that could not be gleaned from dogmas or priests. Monet did not even go inside the church until his project was well advanced, and then only because a statue was being dedicated at a high mass that was being sung by a 300-member Parisian choir. By affirming the value of tangible experience over the mysteries of traditional religion, Monet was expressing the progressive beliefs of his moment. Religion is being replaced by intellectual activities, one of his contemporaries observed." What has happened here? We no longer have an assumption that any particular sacred space is a microcosm of the divine. Rather, what has happened is that space has become secularized, and hence there is embodied in it no necessary intrinsic meaning. Rather, its meaning is attributed, and as we will see, increasingly only corporately. The very multiplicity of the impressions of the cathedral's facade in the Monet painting seem to efface the sacred character of the building. How can it be sacred if you need 15 paintings to show what it is? Its sacred status required its singularity, which Monet rejected in order to understand it. But this mode of understanding was a preview of both the Cubist and even MTV, as I would argue tomorrow if we had the equipment, but it turns out, unfortunately, that we don't. What Monet was trying to do, as Tucker puts it, is to paint a certain kind of experience. This experience renders not only participation in or perception of an event and the feelings associated with the event, but also registers a broad range of sensations so that things are understood to disclose themselves only very slowly, and only after a long process do they become known in their fullest dimension. This experience of a complex kind moves beyond a dichotomy of subject and object, of cognition and emotion. This, I think, is one of the hardest things for us to understand about modern ways of seeing, especially in art, because we are born and bred to believe in a subject-object dichotomy. The experience can be conveyed only in many, many paintings of what in the Renaissance would have been one huge and grand perspective in oil. The cubists then combined the series into one canvas. You no longer have to have 25 paintings of a haystack. You have one complicated painting of a haystack viewed from all possible perspectives on one flat canvas in cubism. Or as John Berger connects this with the fugitive character of reality as the Impressionists saw it, he says, "For the cubist, the visible was no longer what confronted the single eye, but the totality of possible views taken from points all around the object or person being depicted. The visible," I'm going to read that again, "was no longer what confronted the single eye, but the totality of possible views taken from points all around the object or person being depicted." In other words, there is an attempt again to paint as God sees. There was at the Monet exhibit in Boston, across the street at the Museum School, another exhibit. It was a huge pile of bales of hay. The pile was maybe about four times as big as this altar, just stacks of bales of hay. And about 20 feet away from the stacks of bales of hay was a huge gilded picture frame, completely empty, just the frame suspended there, so that you could stand and look at the haystacks through the gilded frame. This was obviously a marvelously self-referential critical joke by the students at the Museum of Art at the school, because what they were saying was that if you've seen Monet's haystacks, you now can create the artistic meaning of this pile of hay that we've stacked up by our school. And indeed, the meaning of that haystack was the sum total of what every viewer constructed it to be in the course of the exhibit itself. This brings me to the last point in this developing consciousness before I turn to some consequences for Lutheran theology. What happens when Goya and Monet and the photograph and electricity and the cubists are all combined? That's the kind of question that I like. One answer is indeed music videos. I've got to stop and check. Now we're going to have honesty time here, friends. How many of you have ever seen a music video? How many of you have seen more than one? How many of you see them regularly? How many of you live with teenagers? Right, that's the question over here. The interpreting of time and space in music videos draws on the precedent set in the art history already described. Just as Goya transcended even Newtonian space, and so also stretched time into the insufferably eternal present, so most music videos, other than folk rock and some rap, portray space and time as a visual analog of Stephen Hawking's wildest imagination. With computer art, it is possible for the viewer to move around all aspects of a cubist sculpture at all times during its creation without any hindrance of gravity or duration. This element of virtual reality has been in music video almost from the start. The precedent is not only in so-called fine art, which I think can clearly be traced in this modern development, but also in animated cartoons and fairy tales. In other lectures, I developed the thesis that music videos are the contemporary form of the verbal fairy tales that children used to read in the old days. There is a feminist cultural analysis of MTV that I don't think I'll deal with because I had included it in part to prepare for tomorrow. But what I want to turn to are some questions of epistemology that I think arise out of this for theology. The positive one of the positive contributions of MTV, to summarize a few pages here, is that it refuses to grant the epistemological necessity of dichotomized thinking. Every binary opposition that our dominant culture uses, subject-object, male-female, good-bad, dark-light, is undercut in the computer art that's used in music videos. It's somewhat related to what the astronaut said about how we place globes on Earth. And I hope many of you have taken their advice and take the globe that you have at home and always turn its south pole up. Because we just assume that the north is up on the Earth, and it's absurd from that perspective away from the planet. And the same way in video art, your expectations of what ought to be the case of binary opposition are completely undercut. And therefore, I think it's a very salutary way of subverting expected knowing in the culture. And a lot of videos do exactly that on social justice themes. But I think there's that one of the great epistemological challenges posed by the modern temper in art is posed in paintings, as in really contemporary paintings, as much as in MTV. I don't know how many of you have seen Tim Rollins' group KOS, the kids from New York City, who paint these marvelous textual subversions in huge canvases. I like that work, especially in the retelling of children's stories, to make this point. Or there's a contemporary artist named Annette Lemieux who does a lot of subverting of nursery rhymes in visual painting. But the epistemological challenge here is a challenge which claims that knowing of reality is an act of multiple consciousness. Knowing of reality is an act of multiple consciousness. Parenthetical. A former student of mine just received a letter of interest to publish her dissertation. And I was reminded when she asked me if I would write again a recommendation, which I was happy to do, I was reminded of how absurd the dissertation defense was. We had worked very cooperatively as first reader and students on these dissertations. I refused to fall into that old hierarchical notion which construes the dissertation as the product of a patriarchal system which makes the first reader the doctor, father, and all that kind of stuff. So we had worked very cooperatively. And then all of a sudden, the dissertation defense comes along, and it's completely this individual having to defend her work alone again. I thought this is really very strange. As strange as having people work competitively and individualistically in graduate school at all. And many of you went through a system which said that if you cooperated, you were cheating. That kind of epistemological assumption says that you know individually that your singular brain is the agent of knowing. And unless you can do it individually and autonomously, you do not really know. You've got to prove that you can sit in a room all by yourself and spew out knowledge in order to prove that you are capable and competent. The modern shift is a denial and rejection of that claim. Put differently, what has been called objectivity is obtained not by purging the individual knower of material experience and hence of bias or interest, but rather in this new understanding, objectivity, that is reliable knowing of the world, is potentially the end result of a cooperative knowing, and a cooperative knowing of as diverse an ensemble of knowers as exists in the society. And that's why Lutheran seminaries are in such bad shape. Being a Renaissance man, or even a liberal, in a liberal egalitarianism, a Renaissance woman, misses the point. That ideal depends on the universality of the center which grounded the universe, the European convention of perspective. To be a Renaissance person is to have a universal perspective and know everything. And if not from MTV, then at least from Monet and Goya, the impossibility of that universal center has, I think, finally been made obvious to all but the most obtuse few. Now, what that has to do with Lutheran theology is as follows. And I'll summarize a section here very briefly. The next section has to do with the impossibility of a liberal Enlightenment epistemology, which basically draws on that same European assumption of universal knowing. I think that we still, especially through the neo-Orthodox period of Lutheran theology in the United States, operated with that epistemology. We really worked as if modernity had not happened. We used the same assumptions of knowing that were used in Luther's time or in the period of the most intense Orthodoxy. I think certain questions are posed to Lutheran epistemology by virtue of this modern development. And I'll summarize them, and we can talk about them at the fireside tomorrow night if I stay awake. Or tomorrow morning. We're going to do something very different tomorrow morning. We're going to use different methodology completely. I think that Lutheran social ethics has some resources to participate in this decentering of the autonomous self and liberal epistemology. The best of Lutheran tradition, I think, can cope with this. And the first best of the Lutheran tradition is as follows in this regard. The freedom of the Christian is construed in the best of the tradition as a socially located freedom. The paradox of the perfectly free and wholly bound or contingent or interdependent other connected person is a way to resist the binary opposition of individual and society that dominated the liberal epistemology. The freedom of the Christian is a socially embodied freedom, just as the temptation to totalizing, or to use the technical term, the temptation to incorvatus in se, is also socially embodied. Luther knew this. Whether Lutherans since have remembered it is another question. The second major contribution of the best of Lutheran tradition, the social construction of the person, and that was marvelously dealt with in one of its expressions in the lecture this afternoon, in one current theory dealing with this. The social construction of the person is in Lutheran tradition from the start. The kind of individualistic autonomous self as knower has never been, from the beginning of the Reformation, at the core of what the understanding of the person was. In traditional Lutheran teaching, it's called the coram relationships of Luther, that we are constituted coram Deo, we are constituted by being in the presence of the deity, and then also in the other coram relationships. That is, who we are as selves is not essentialist, idealist constituted, but always created in relationship. Luther knew that. We are created in relationship with God, with self, with others, with institutions, and with nature. So what is the self then? Constantly this process of activity, contingency, dependence, limitation, and dynamic daily creating of self have been in Lutheran anthropology, always in preference to an essentialist or idealist definition of the person. And it's really too bad that some of the people in Lutheran tradition who are arguing this essentialist definition of the person, and I name people like Broughton especially, but also Jensen and a few others, it's too bad that they aren't being challenged on their anthropological assumptions, which are assumptions that are appropriate to some era but not ours. The third major contribution of Lutheran tradition is what Stephen Osmond called the soteriological desubstantializing of the person, which means justification by grace through faith, basically. But this desubstantializing of the person in favor of a relational understanding of justification leads to a rejecting, I think, of any ideological limitation in the communal defining of the social good. What this means is that Lutherans can risk entertaining the possibility that we do not yet ever know what the true form of the social good is, and that we can therefore participate rather daringly in the constant creating of that definition and the embodying of it. What this means is to totalize or to reduce reality whether that's free market or capitalism or systems on the left, is excluded in this epistemology. Or to put it most simply, if you want to know the truth on these premises of soteriology and Lutheran teaching, if you want to know the truth, you always open up the discourse. You never close it down. Always open it up. Always include more diversity in the discourse, because justification is by grace and not by material definitions of the truth. I think the ELCA, very frankly, has lost this, so far as I can tell. The final point, the integrity of the world itself as a locus of the good is one of the things that made me become a Lutheran. I was raised German Congregationalist. I became a Lutheran because I read Luther, and one of the things that really inspired me about Luther's theology was that the guy was so earthy. He talked constantly as if being physical mattered, which I found very rare in the church, and he talked about it not as only that it mattered, but that it was good. And it was fun, and it was enjoyable to be physical. Now, you might not remember that from your Luther classes, but very few Lutheran seminaries require the reading of Luther, if the truth be known. That's true. It's true. Now, if we focus on the integrity of the world itself as the locus of the good, that is, embodiment as the locus of the good, I think there's no need to sacrifice this claim for the theological claim about the pervasiveness of evil so that we have sufficient evil to justify a theory of the atonement which places more emphasis on the divinity of Jesus than on his humanity. That's my sentence for saying the following in another word. I think far too often we sacrifice the theological claim of the goodness of the physical in order to up the ante on the presence of evil so that we've got a good reason to have a divine Jesus. We need a lot of work on theories of atonement in Lutheran theology, and we need them, I think, beginning with a re-estimation of the relationship between the material world and the divine. This has a lot to do with how we interpret sexuality. So my final sentence is that, and it's in the form of a question. What I have been arguing in this lecture is that difference is integral to modern knowing, and attempts to obtain homogeneity are deadly. And so it leads to the final question. Is denial of difference integral to the unity of the church theologically? Is denial of difference integral to the unity of the church theologically? That is, does baptism confer a homogeneous identity which makes us all the same and hence unified in the church? Or is it more Lutheran to say that only difference can be the premise for the unity of the church? That's a question I want to pursue in two more sessions. One will be more like a lecture and one won't. I won't tell you what I'll do tomorrow now that we don't have the video, but I can guarantee you it will be participatory. So I think I'll stop there. I don't want to say anything more, frankly. And I think I've brought us just close enough to worship so that I won't even ask about questions. But we'll have a lot of time for, I'm not trying to escape that, we have a lot of time for that tomorrow. And frankly, I read body language pretty well, mine and yours. And I think we'll quit. Any objection? Good. None? We're done.